Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:04 p.m. on Monday, April 12, 2021. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Vance, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, my Vice Chair, Representative Snyder, who is joining us by Teams, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. I think you all received the notice. Our original plan was to hear from Mr. White for the Police Standards Council, but he apparently resigned his position in the Ketchikan Police Department very recently and is no longer up for consideration for this nomination. So our first order of business today is House Bill 116, Juveniles, Justice, Facilities, Treatment, sponsored by Representative Sponholz. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. As those of you who served on the House Judiciary Committee during the 30th legislative session and the 31st legislative session may remember, we have heard this bill. We heard this in April 2018 and moved the bill from committee. We heard a similar bill again in February 2020 and moved it from committee. He introduced the bill as Representative Sponholz and her staff, Megan Holland. If you would both please come forward, identify yourselves to the record, and you can begin your remarks. And I'll just note for the committee, my plan will be after they finish their presentation, we will turn immediately to invited testimony and we'll hold on questions until the invited testimony is complete.
All right. I'm Representative Ivy Sponholz from House District 16 in East Anchorage. Thanks very much to the chair and members of the committee for hearing HB 116 today. HB 16 essentially does three things. It closes a loophole related to sexual abuse of a minor. Two, it updates terminology that define and reference Division of Juvenile Justice facilities and staff and codifies the division's best practices. So, the first provision, the sexual abuse of a minor loophole, came to light in 2017 when a Division of Juvenile Justice staff member was acquitted after sustaining an inappropriate sexual relationship with a minor previously under his supervision. HB 116 closes this loophole by adding DJJ staff to the list of individuals in a position of authority over DJJ youth and therefore makes them makes it inappropriate for them to have a sexual relationship with those folks. Number two, it updates terminology. Important clarifications in language we use to describe Division of Juvenile Justice facilities and staff and update statutes to accurately reflect the authorities and responsibilities of the division. This section, these provisions don't substantively change the way the Division of Juvenile Justice operates, but it does improve their ability to complete their mission and codify its best practices to ensure safe and secure treatment of juveniles in Alaska. The bulk of the bill, I will just clarify, it's a long bill.
I'll take a brief pause to note that Representative Kirka joined us about a minute ago.
All right. Welcome.
Please continue.
The bulk of the bill updates language used in state statute to describe the facilities operated by the Division of Juvenile Justice that are outdated, inaccurate, or obsolete. Finally, it codifies best practices of the division and clarifies their authority. These changes resolve issues that came to light over time or they simply reflect the standard operations of the division. For example, it adds DJJ staff and probation officers to the list of mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect, clarifies that DJJ probation officers have the authority to file amended petitions. In the past, some petitions have been denied, inhibiting juvenile probation officers from advocating for youth when new information comes to light in their case, corrects language authorizing the department to disclose confidential information related to the offense when a minor received an adjudication rather than the offense the minor was alleged to have committed. In summary, HB 116 improves the division's ability to complete their mission. And Megan Holland, my aide, has a presentation which covers the bill in more detail. And then, as the chair referenced, we have representatives from the Division of Juvenile Justice to testify as to the need and to be available for more questions.
Ms. Holland, please proceed.
For the record, Megan Holland, staff to bill sponsor, Representative Ivy Sponholz. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Moving to slide two of the presentation, this Under Section 6 of the bill, it resolves the sexual abuse of a minor issue that the bill sponsor references, clearly listing DJJ staff as being in a position of authority over minors in their custody. Slide 3, this is a list of all of the terms and definitions that House Bill 116 either repeals, amends, or creates to more accurately reflect the facilities that the Division of Juvenile Justice operates, as well as the positions that they have. For example, it repeals youth counselors. The division doesn't have the position of youth counselors, and the legislation also creates a definition for juvenile probation officers, for which there is currently no accurate definition in state statute. Many of these terms and conditions used to describe the Division of Juvenile Justice are decades old and in need of revision. So going into more detail on the changes of definitions and terminology in the bill, first with the repealed terms and definitions on slide 4. As I mentioned, youth counselors under section 26 of the bill, the position of youth counselors is repealed. This statute is around 50 years old, and the position has not existed within the division since 2003. Additionally, the duties described under this section do not accurately apply to probation officers. Section 3 of the bill repeals the current definition under state statute for juvenile probation officers, which currently inaccurately defines the position, limiting officers to being officers who who oversee individuals 18 or 19 years of age and in their custody. And it is not unlikely for these juvenile probation officers to have individuals 20 or even in rare cases 21 years of age in their custody. And this is corrected with a new definition under Section 26. Additionally, in multiple sections of the bill cited on slide 4, you can see we are repealing outdated or inaccurate terms for the facilities that the Division of Juvenile Justice operates, including juvenile detention homes, youth detention facilities, correctional school, juvenile work camps. These are facilities that the division does not operate, and in some cases has never operated, and so we are repealing those terms and replacing them with more accurate terminology, juvenile detention facility and juvenile treatment facility, both for accuracy and consistency in state statute. And moving to slide 5, we have the amended definitions in House Bill 116. In section 30 of the bill, it amends the definition of minor to include a person who was under 18 at the time they committed the offense and or subject to the jurisdiction of DJJ. As I stated earlier, there are times when youth are committed and remain in DJJ's custody after they turn 19. Additionally, sections 29 and 37 of the bill amend the definition of juvenile detention facility. Currently, it limits a juvenile detention facility to separate quarters within a city jail. And this is a little exclusive. In some communities, they do not have a jail suitable for detaining juveniles. It doesn't meet sight and sound separation from adult federal requirements. And so we're amending that definition as well. Moving to slide 6, these are the new definitions created under House Bill 116. First being juvenile treatment facilities. under Section 31 of the bill. This is a relatively simple change from the word institutions to facility rather than juvenile treatment institutions. The division would prefer juvenile treatment facilities. It's just a more accurate reflection of the facilities they operate. And under Section 31 of the bill, the legislation creates a new definition for temporary secure juvenile holding areas. And the division currently operates with a list of temporary secure holding areas in various communities across the state. And these are, you know, those communities where, you know, a community jail or other sort of detaining facility is not available. So they work with communities to establish those.
You can pause for just a moment. I recognize that Representative Eastman also joined us a minute or two ago. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. And lastly, Section 26 of the bill creates a new definition for juvenile probation officers. As I currently stated, there isn't currently a definition for this position, and Section 26 provides a new definition for this position and affords them the powers of a probation officer and clearly describes their duties. Moving on to slide 7. As the bill sponsor mentioned, another element of this legislation is aligning state statutes with the best practices of the division and making clarifications to help the division achieve their mission. And here are some of those clarifications. Section 5 of the bill clarifies that employees of juvenile treatment institutions and juvenile adult probation officers qualify as legal guardians for those youth committed to them in their custody. Section 16 and 18 provide juvenile probation officers clearly with the authority to file amended and supplemental petitions with the court. And Sections 24 and 25 clarify that the authority to arrest and detain minors rests with juvenile, not adult probation officers. Additionally, on slide 8, Section 27 adds secure residential psychiatric treatment centers to the list of facilities from which, when a juvenile is released, victims will be notified. Current statute limits this to DJJ facilities. Section 28 corrects language authorizing the department to disclose confidential information related to actual adjudicated offenses rather than offenses the minor was alleged to have committed, which is what is under current statute. Section 40 adds juvenile probation officers, DJJ office staff, and staff of juvenile facilities to the list of mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect. This is currently the policy of the division, and they make, on average, over the past several years, over 100 reports to OCS on an annual basis. And Section 41 repeals a revocation of juvenile driver's licenses for offenses involving a controlled substance that were handled informally by the division. And just to clarify, this legislation doesn't provide that youth driver's licenses can't be revoked. It just clarifies that it's not the division that does it, it's handled through the district courts. And slide 9, in summary, as stated by the bill sponsor, House Bill 116 closes sexual abuse of a minor loophole, updates terms and definitions relating to DJJ facilities and staff to accurately reflect the division, and it codifies their best practices to improve their ability to complete their mission. And with that, we're available for any questions members have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to questions, we're going to hear from invited testimony. I believe we have two individuals online to provide invited testimony. I'll start with Tracy Dompling, Director, Division of Juvenile Justice. Ms. Dompling, I believe you're with us on Teams. If you want to introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, Tracy Gonfling, Director for the Division of Juvenile Justice. Thank you, Chair Clayman and committee members, for the opportunity to present today on HB 116 to address both long-identified and newly emerging statutory issues that are related to juvenile justice. HB 16 was introduced at the request of the division, and we want to thank Representative Sponholz for her willingness to continue to work with the division to sponsor these important statutory updates. It's been our pleasure working with both Representative Sponholz and Ms. Holland on this legislation. As Chair Clayman already stated, this is the third time this committee has actually heard this bill, and some may be familiar with it from previous legislative hearings. With the addition of a few fixes, HB 116 mirrors HB 133 from last legislative session that was moved out of this committee during the closing days of the last legislature. DJJ's original 4712 statutes were passed when the division became its own separate division approximately 20 years ago. The updates to statutes and definitions in HB 16 also mirror our efforts to improve the success of youth engaged in juvenile justice system through best practices and innovative approaches to address youth delinquency. Although the bulk of the bill is conforming changes to the definitions of DJJ facilities and staff, these definitions have real impact on the work that we do and youth safety. As has been stated previously, the most dramatic is the criminal case against a former DJJ employee who was acquitted for sexual abuse due to the lack of an updated definition for DJJ staff in the definition of position of authority. So I want to thank you for your consideration today. I'm happy to answer questions that any of you may have, and our Social Services Program Officer, Matt Davidson, is also on the call for questions.
Quick question, is Mr. Davidson providing invited testimony, or is he here for questions only?
Questions only, thank you.
Okay. So that brings us to questions for members of the committee. And you'll have questions for either the bill sponsor or the bill sponsor staff, Ms. Dompling or Mr. Davidson. I'm not hearing or seeing any from the committee. I have one question. I believe this may be for Ms. Dompling. We've already heard in this committee House Bill 105, which has to do with, I would broadly say, some of the sight and sound separation requirements. Is there overlap between House Bill 105 and House Bill 116, and how should we view that overlap as we move forward?
Mr. Chair, there may be a little overlap. I'm actually going to have Matt Davidson answer that question because he's been knee-deep in both of these particular bills.
All right, Mr. Davidson, you're on point for this one.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Davidson. I'm a Social Services Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. You are correct, Mr. Chairman. There is overlap of a couple of sections between these two bills. They don't conflict in any way, but we chose with the new bill, which is responding to the changes in federal law related to holding status offenders in secure custody and the major issue of waived minors, holding them in juvenile justice facilities. We chose not to mirror the changes that we make in HB 116 in HB 105 in terms of the definitions of the facilities, just because we thought it would get confusing if both bills were mirroring the changes or trying to mirror the changes. So when these bills, depending on which bill moves faster and passes the legislature, we might need to do some alignment. I don't think they're confusing. I don't think they conflict. But there are some updated definitions used where we describe our facilities. No, we're not calling them detention homes in our facilities, detention homes in HB 116, but in HB 105, the term detention home remains in the statute for the section that it amends, if that's clear.
Does that mean that there's language in this bill that is identical to language that's in 105, or are you saying that the provisions in 105, none of those actual provisions are showing up in House Bill 116?
To the chair, yes, so the latter. So there are the changes that we propose in this bill, HB 116, that correct the definitions are not showed in the waiver bill that deals with waived minors that this committee has already heard. So we still use old terms in those sections that we amend in HB 105. And HB 105 does not contain the changes. This bill does not contain the updates related to compliance with the federal law that HB 105 corrects.
So your perspective is that they involve similar topics, but they're kind of on parallel tracks doing different things towards the same end.
That is my sense, Mr. Chairman. I believe that if both bills passed, the revisor of statutes could pretty clearly understand the intent of the legislature without having one or both of them being combined or aligned.
And then the other query I had for Ms. Holland, you were referencing Section 41 and involving license revocations related to with substance abuse charges, and you referenced being dealt with by the district courts. And I was just curious if that's how you're getting juveniles in district court or why they're being in district court as opposed to superior court.
Chair Clayman, for the record, Megan Hall and staff to Rep. Sponholz. I think that question actually might be better answered by Mr. Davidson.
Okay. All right. And I note that Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Court System, is also available, so she may be better able to answer that question. Mr. Davidson, can you answer the question I directed to Ms.?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Again, this is Matt Davidson with the division. It's the revocation of driver's licenses that was contained in Division of Juvenile Justice Statute. Both included one offense for underage drinking and then a few different offenses related to misconduct involving a controlled substance. A bill that passed in 2016 repealed the alcohol-related repeal of driver's licenses that the division was required to request because that crime, that offense no longer was in the division's jurisdiction. There remains in our statute a reference to the division repealing driver's licenses for minors who are charged with, and we receive a police report about a misconduct involving controlled substances. And the section that we're repealing, 4712060B5, deals with the least serious misconduct involving controlled substances cases where the division says, we're going to handle this case, what we say, informally. And it doesn't go to adjudication, that we meet with the family. And those often are possession of marijuana, for example, is referred to the division. And if we don't think there's a real, if the parents don't think there's a real problem, and we the division don't think there's a reason to go to a formal court action, they could go to youth court or some other action. This provision would still require that we repeal the youth driver's licenses and inform DMV that we would repeal their driver's license. There is no corollary in our statute any longer that makes us repeal driver's licenses for more serious offenses involving controlled substances. And so this is just providing parity across our statute.
Right, but the question I'm asking is more a jurisdictional question. When you bring a juvenile matter, that's always in the superior court. And so there's
correct.
A jurisdiction issue about how does a person who is not being dealt with as a juvenile delinquent is showing up in district court, and that's the question I'm asking. So if you can provide a little bit of illumination of why somebody that shouldn't be, I mean, if there's a juvenile delinquency matter, that's never going to be in district court. So how is that showing up in district court now, and how does this revision affect district court and people who are under 18 and being in district court?
My apologies, Mr. Chairman. Again, Matt Davidson. Yes. So I believe Ms. Holland misspoke related to district court and drug offenses. Drug offenses would not be a district court offense. The district court conversation is dealing with how underage drinking is dealt with now. So all minor consuming alcohol cases are referred to district court. And the district court still has authority to request repeals of driver's licenses through another statute in Title 28 and Title 4, I believe. But in Title 28, the court still has the authority to repeal minors' driver's licenses. And that is a district court decision, not a superior court decision.
But those are essentially being treated as non-juvenile matters because the juvenile is actually identified in those cases as if they were an adult.
You're talking about alcohol offenses, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, so Ms. Mead can speak to this directly, but the legislature did change the law related to underage drinking in 2016 and made those offenses not part of court view, and I think Ms. Mead could really speak to the confidentiality related to district court and underage drinking.
Ms. Mead, can you give us a little bit more clarity on what's going on with juvenile jurisdiction and these offenses, because I'm finding that answers from the division a little less than clear.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. When juveniles are charged with minor consuming, as Mr. Davidson said, they are not treated as a juvenile. Under Title 47, they're treated as an adult. Minor consuming alcohol is now a straight violation, so they are exactly like a traffic ticket, and traffic tickets go to the district court and not to the superior court. The court system does not revoke driver's licenses for minor consuming. The defendant, if convicted, receives a fine only. The minor is able to reduce the fine in accordance with the provision in Title IV. But the court does have jurisdiction or the ability to revoke driver's licenses of a minor for two things. One is misconduct involving a controlled substance under 1171, and also the illegal use or possession of a firearm. Some of those would be in superior court, as Mr. Chairman noted, so I'm not sure if that helps clarify it, but that is how a minor could be in district court.
Does that mean that the minor, I understand with regard to the minor consuming, that's a violation, and so even though they're under 18, they show up like a traffic citation. But what about the misconduct involving controlled substances and the weapons misconduct? Can those be brought in district court only, and are they treated as an adult because it's brought as a violation, or do those all have to go through the superior court?
Mr. Chairman, it is my belief that those are handled by the superior court and not the district court.
Okay. So this bill is only addressing, as to district court, that's only addressing matters that, well, it sounds like it's not addressing those at all. It sounds like we're talking about changing the law about controlled substance cases and what can even be brought in juvenile court at all.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davidson could perhaps correct me, but I am not aware that this changes jurisdiction for controlled substances for juveniles.
Okay. Mr. Davidson, are there any violations that would be treated purely as violations either of controlled substance laws or of weapons laws that would end up with a juvenile in district court, or is this the only district court play when it involves minor consuming?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, any referral to the Division of Juvenile Justice for misconduct involving controlled substances or weapons would be handled by Superior Court and not the District Court, delinquency cases. The mix is between the alcohol and this revocation question. Yes, you're correct. There's no changes in jurisdiction in this bill at all. It's only the change that we are talking about, I think, is just related to the duty of the division to seek the revocation of driver's licenses for informal delinquency cases.
Okay. I know that was kind of a long list of questions from the chair. Any other questions from members of the committee for any of the folks available for questions or the bill sponsor and his staff? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Just looking for a little bit of clarity. So I know sections 24 and 25 deal with arrest authority, and I'm wondering to what extent this bill changes the ability of those adult probation officers to be called upon to aid in the arrest of a minor.
For the record, Tracy Dompling, Director of Division of Juvenile Justice, through the Chair, Representative Eastman. I don't believe that that's what, I mean, that's certainly not what we're requesting. Youth that are under the supervision of the Division of Juvenile Justice, being we're under Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Corrections probation officers don't have the authority to intervene and arrest a juvenile in one of our matters.
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
So are you saying that this bill would not impact the arrest authority for an adult probation officer?
Through the Chair, Representative Eastman, correct.
Thank you.
Another question, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. Yes, through the Chair. So in Section 28, we're talking about correcting language, dealing with confidential information. Looks like we're making a switch from alleged to have committed to actually adjudicated offenses. And I'm wanting to know, so who would have access to that confidential information in current statute, and then how does that change with the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davidson might be happy to respond to that question. Again, Matt Davidson with the division. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this section of our confidentiality statute, as you can see, it's 4712.315C. There's a lack of alignment between 315A, B, and C. And so this correction actually just aligns Section 315C with Section 315A and B related to when the division is authorized to release the information. A specifies that the division can release information about to the public. So any member of the public can ask information about a particular class of offenses at a certain point. And that point is after adjudication. And so what this change does is just aligns that when you are releasing the information to the member of public or the media that's asking about it, you're releasing the information about what they're actually adjudicated for, not what they were originally alleged to have committed. So that's just the only alignment that's happening there. It's when it's allowed to be released, you're releasing it to the member of the public who's requested it as authorized by law, and it's the information. And one of the pieces you're releasing is the offense that they were convicted of, adjudicated of, not what they originally were charged with in the first petition that was filed.
And follow up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So I am curious, with the passage of this bill, who would the division have the ability to give this confidential information to prior to the offense being adjudicated?
I'll go ahead and answer that. For the record, Tracy Dompling, Director, Division of Juvenile Justice. Through the chair, Representative Eastman. So according to the statute, there's certain times, certain situations under which if a member of the public perhaps reaches out and asks about a specific youth and an incident, that we could give that basic information that's listed in statute. So what we're trying to do here is clarify that It's only for those offenses which are adjudicated, not offenses for which youth have been referred to the division and adjusted. So those are cases where the youth has not had formal court action taken against them. They haven't been afforded an attorney, all of those due process rights that come with the formal adjudication versus the informal adjudication.
Follow up. Representative Eastman.
Thank you to the chair. No, still not getting to what I'm looking for. So if, for example, my child is alleged to have committed an offense, am I able as a parent or guardian to have access to the confidential information prior to the adjudicated offense? Or do I have to wait until after the offense has been adjudicated to find out that information?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if your child was the subject of a delinquency petition, you would be a party to that hearing. So you would also receive a copy of the petition for adjudication of delinquency that would outline the allegations that were against your child. And you, although you wouldn't be represented by the Public Defender Agency, you would be at all of those hearings being able to hear what's going on. So you would actually have more information as a parent, as a party to those particular delinquency hearings before the Superior Court, than what a member of the public under this public disclosure is actually able to receive. So public disclosure is that basic information and just a very snippet of, you know, John Doe was adjudicated for breaking into a dwelling and stealing a firearm. That would be it. Versus what's actually outright listed in a petition, which has the whole information of probable cause kind of outlining that information about the actual charge.
Thank you. Final follow-up?
Representative Eastman, actually, Ms. Holland was waving on. Did you have anything to add to what the answer we just received?
Yes, for the record, Megan Holland, through the chair, I just want to clarify that this bill does not change what information will or can be disclosed. It simply clarifies that, who can receive the information. It just clarifies what information can be disclosed. So we're not changing who will have access to it. We're just clarifying that it'll only be information about adjudicated cases, not allegations.
Representative Eastman, follow up. I thought we'd get that info out before you got your next question.
Great. I appreciate that. Thank you. And through the chair. So again, if there's confidential information, is that able to be released to anyone prior to the adjudication of the offense that is, using the example of a moment ago, that is not party to the issue? So obviously parents, guardians, if they're party, they'll have that information. They won't need to ask for it. But if you're not party, is there a list of people who can have access to that confidential information? If there is a list, who's on it? Thank you.
Through the chair,
Go ahead, Matt. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this is Matt Davidson with the division. Yeah, and the section 4712.310 specifies the regardless of the status of the case, when the division can share information with non-parties to the case. So the victim, the parents, the attorneys, those people are built into statute. Also, we do have provisions in our statute that allow us to share information with insurance companies as necessary, as appropriate, with other law enforcement agencies to continue investigations. Obviously, the attorneys involved in the case. Also, youth that aren't adjudicated often receive services through the division or through a private residential. So they're never adjudicated, but we refer them to services. And we are allowed to share information, appropriate information regarding their case, to make sure that those youth get the right services as part of their delinquency proceedings, or, you know, basically rectifying their wrong and proceeding through their court. You know, they may not go through court cases, but they're going to certainly get services. Adjudication isn't the only outcome that we seek.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I expressed some of the similar concerns of the overlap of HB 105, and I was just looking, and it appears HB 105 is in Health and Social Services Committee, and I would like to, instead of leaving it up to, you know, kind of the end is that as a legislature that we coordinate the consistent language so that it's clear what our intent is to make sure that there is matching language and conformity between the two, and whatever we need to do to rectify that, I think would be appropriate.
And thanks, Representative Vance. I would note that as a result of the decisions by the Speaker on Friday, this bill was originally, its first referral was to HESS and second referral was to this committee, and 105 came to this committee first and HESS second, and we did that in part because trying to add some work for our committee to work on. So I think what we can do, because we have heard the opinion offered, but we can always double check and see if we agree with that opinion. The opinion's been offered from I think from Mr. Davidson that they're parallel but not overlapping, and I think it would be incumbent upon us at this point perhaps to review that and see if we agree with their conclusion. But I think we certainly have that capacity in this committee, and if we do find there's overlap, then I think the next question would be how to eliminate that, because I certainly don't think if there's two identical sections in both bills, we ought not to do that. But if they're parallel but not in the same tracks, then that's not a big deal.
That thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was the first thing that stood out to me is, hey, I've heard some of this language before, and I think one of the intent of the of Representative Sponholz with this bill is to simplify and make a consistency in language, which I greatly appreciate because that helps clarify moving forward instead of having five different definitions, you know, names that creates an ambiguity that we rectify those. And when we're dealing with things regarding the detention, it's something that we want to get right, and think that however it needs to be, if we need to talk to people in HESS or, you know, whatever I think is appropriate, because we want to make sure that there's no more loopholes that could go unnoticed. And I just appreciate you bringing this forward again. I'm going to take a look at why it's taken so long to get it moved through, but I understand that some of these things take some time to get right. So if you could speak to that of the past history of this bill, mm-hmm. that would be helpful for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vance, through the chair.
Representative Vance, you are pushing the edges on the one-minute question, but we'll let the bill sponsor respond.
Representative Vance, through the chair, we actually came very close towards finishing this last session, and honestly, I think that if we'd been around here for a couple more weeks, we would have finished it. There was a companion bill last session that was working its way through the Senate as well, and we were in the process of marrying them up in Senate Finance, I believe, and so we were making lots of progress. We were just about ready to cross the finish line and just didn't. The bill is long and complicated, and we had other priorities in the previous legislative session, which you have to sometimes prioritize amongst the legislation you carry. And so we weren't able to move it in that first legislative session all the way through. We were very close last time. And just didn't quite make across the finish line. It wasn't because of concern or controversy or a lack of, commitment on the part of the sponsor to move it. It was just we got cut short due to COVID, and it became a lower priority because of COVID.
Thank you.
Representative Easton, is that a question?
Question, yes. Thank you, through the chair. So I am particularly interested in Section 30, where we are redefining what a minor is. I understand, part of this deals with making sure that certain minors will remain in DJJ custody after their 18th birthday. That makes sense to me. But I'm also wondering where, how broad of a scope this change of the word minor is going to be, and what other statutes is this going to impact who already have the word minor in them and are now subject to this new definition?
I'll give Ms. Dombling the first. Mr. Dombling or Ms. Dombling or Mr. Davidson, I'll let one of you speak first and go for it.
Absolutely. For the record, Tracy Dompling, Director of Division of Juvenile Justice, and I apologize, I'm not sure who asked that question, but through the chair to the representative. What we're looking at when we talk about B of that section to the jurisdiction, individuals who are jurisdiction to, under the jurisdiction of the court with this chapter. So what, just to kind of give the information, so if an individual, say, on the night of their 18th birthday commits burglary in the first degree, it used to be several years ago that if no one found out about it until the individual was 18 years old, we didn't have jurisdiction because they theoretically weren't a minor under the age of 18 anymore. So I can't remember how long ago it was, but the statute changed so we would still be able to hold individuals accountable for those offenses that happened prior to their 18th birthday. We were able to get restitution for victims in those matters. So it was changed, and what we are able to do as well is in significant cases, especially high amounts of restitution or serious crimes against a person, we can actually petition someone when they're 18 years of age if they were, again, subject to the jurisdiction that they committed that offense prior to their 18th birthday. So we don't think it's opening up, a ton, because we clearly try to state in here that subject to the jurisdiction of the court under this chapter. So we're trying to keep it narrowed to the chapter.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So I understand what you were just saying about for offenses before someone was 18, but of course the traditional definition of minor would apply there because they weren't 18 yet. What I'm specifically looking for is, has anyone evaluated where else in the chapter this definition of minor is changing, and what impacts that this new definition is going to cause? Thank you.
I'll let Mr. Davidson see if he can answer that question better than I could. So,
Mr. Davidson, do you want to take a shot at that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I'm just flipping through my book here to see how our definition section is described. So the changes, again, Mr. Through Chair, Representative Eastman, the definition section that we're talking about is the definition section found in delinquency statute. So it's not, so oftentimes, I mean, I guess I'm not in the best position to describe how the definition of minor would change another section of statute, but those definitions are particular to delinquency statute, and so that's 4712-990, and 4712-990 states, in this chapter, unless the context is otherwise requires, here's the definitions. And so it's particular to this section of statute, or this chapter, 4712, that these definitions apply. I suppose it's possible they could apply elsewhere, but again, there's definitions, sometimes contradictory in statute. That's not the intent here. The intent is to be inclusive of all minors who are under DJJ jurisdiction. The definition of minor here says someone who's currently is someone who's under 18 years of age. As my director has specified, we have jurisdiction for minors who did offenses when they were minors, and then they get older, right? They can either stay in our custody after, we had them through their 18th birthday, or we didn't find out about the offense until after their birthday, and we still have jurisdiction to seek an adjudication for them as a 18-year-old or even 19-year-old in some cases. But it is particular to the delinquency statute where this definition is being amended, and I think the impacts would be pretty minor, or no pun intended, would not occur elsewhere outside of delinquency statute. Well,
the short answer to Representative Eastman's question is that because it's a definition in Title 47, Chapter 12, and Chapter 12 is what deals with delinquent minors, every place that minor shows up in Title 47, Chapter 12, the definition has changed, and it applies in all those instances. I do note that we have another bill up today And we do have a, I want to open public testimony. Are there more questions? I'd like to conclude our work on this particular bill by 2 o'clock today.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sponholz, did you have further response to Representative Eastman's question?
No, actually, I wanted to clarify something I said earlier in response to Representative Ants.
Okay, go ahead.
So I misspoke when referencing where we were with the bill last session. The bill had made it all the way through the House, made it through Senate Hess, and was sitting in Senate Judiciary. It had been referred on March 21st. You might remember that we adjourned at the end of March, and so that's where the bill had ended up. That was this last committee of referral on the Senate side. Just wanted to clarify that.
So it actually passed the House last year.
Yeah.
Any other questions for the folks here?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Davidson. I just might offer to Representative to the question about the alignment between the two DJJ bills. I would offer that
Mr. Davidson
do an analysis.
Mr. Davidson, I think today is not the last bill hearing for this. The committee will have time, but between now and the next time we hear this bill, to compare the two bills, and if we have questions, we can take them up at that time. Is that all right?
That's fine. I was just going to offer to provide the committee with to the sponsor our own summary that would give a side by side between the two bills.
Have you done that already?
Have not.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that? That would be helpful. If you can provide that to my office, we'll distribute it to the committee.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions from the committee. I'm going to open public testimony.
Pardon me.
I'm sorry.
This is Rep. Snyder.
Yes. I apologize if I didn't see you waving.
No problem. Sorry. Thank you. Just sliding in here. Just as co-chair of the Health and Social Services Committee, if we could also receive that side by side, that would help us as we move forward with the other bill. Thank you.
All right. Hearing and seeing no other questions from the committee, we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 116. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear, often difficult to hear what you're saying. We actually have a few people in the room, although I don't think anyone that's in the room wishes to provide public testimony. Looking on the computer screen here, there is no one that is here for public testimony, so I will close public testimony. And we're going to hold the bill for further review. That brings us to our second and final order of business today, House Bill 66, Elections, Voting, Ballots, sponsored by Representative Tuck. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. As those of you who served on the House Judiciary Committee during the 30th legislative session may remember, we heard a version of this bill in April 2017. And move the bill from committee. While House Bill 66 was on that bill, there are additional items like eliminating the witness requirement for absentee ballots, the pay increase for workers, and the curing provisions that may not have been part of the earlier bill. Here to present the bill is Representative Tuck. If you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, as well as your staff, who I see is also coming up, and then you can begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to present House Bill 66. I'm Representative Chris Tuck from South Central Anchorage, District 23, also known as the Diamond Business District. And with me is my staff, Mike Mason. And permission to proceed?
Please proceed, Mr.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2020 was the year to emphasize safe and secure elections. And that happened here in Alaska and also in the other 49 states. And it has been reported that the 2020 general election was one of the most secure in United States and Alaska's history. U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies report no evidence of significant voter fraud and that the 2020 election was secure. And there's a pamphlet that was put out by the Brookings Institute titled It's Official, The Election Was Secure, in which they looked at states that were in question, as well as all the way up to Attorney General Barr and his investigation. Last November, here in Alaska, the most votes ever were cast in an election. And we had 361,000 Alaskans that voted out of 599,687 people that were registered to vote. How did this happen? A lot of it, the increased turnout, was due to the expansion of vote-by-mail opportunities here in Alaska due to the pandemic that it hit. Voters found it more safe and more convenient to vote. And so I'm hoping to achieve two goals with this bill, House Bill 66. And that's allowing voters that once they vote by mail and register to vote by mail, they can check off a box and continue to vote by mail until they miss elections. And to expand the access to voting and modernizing our elections by authorizing the same day voter registration. And that person would be voting as a question ballot that can be verified and validated. It also allows the use of electronic signatures for voter registration. And it requires election officials to notify a voter if their absentee ballot is rejected, giving the voter an opportunity to cure or fix a mailed-in absentee ballot if there were any type of technical errors or errors in any way. And also allows absentee ballots to be counted as they are received instead of waiting until after the polls close on election day. This last year we saw how suspenseful it was, if you will, of not having the actual results of an election until weeks later. Nothing had changed in the way that ballots were processed this last year, but because of the larger number of people voting by mail, it did determine many more election outcomes than normal. House Bill 66 also makes some common sense changes to Alaska's election laws. It clarifies the terminology for early voting to remove confusion between early voting and absentee in-person voting. A lot of people question that. We had problems in rural Alaska where voters turned out to vote early, because we only truly have three locations that are early voting, if I remember correctly, and there's three, and it's Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. All other locations, the early voting is called in-person absentee, and the confusion is, which is it? Are you in-person or are you absentee? And so many voters were not allowed to vote early because they were in person and weren't absentee. So we need to really emphasize the need for training our poll workers to make sure that that doesn't happen again. It also calls for the same day voting locations to be available during every election. Currently, when a voting location or polling place is determined, it's every 10 years during redistricting. And once that's established, it stays that way, so it can't be moving around over the next 10 years, unless there's a fire or some reason that facility is no longer available. It also clarifies that candidates and groups sponsoring ballot initiatives can have poll watchers. It also requires the Division of Elections to provide postage paid return envelope with absentee ballots, eliminating the need for stamps to vote, and creates an option for permanent absentee voting for individuals to plan to vote by mail in every election. Right now, you can fill out your application and receive your primary ballot and then also your general ballot within election cycle. This will continue that going into every election after that. House Bill 66 will also make it more convenient to vote before Election Day and make it an easier vote on Election Day. And it will help us move toward a more equitable and accessible voting system for all by putting the voters first, making sure every Alaskan has one vote. We should make it convenient for them to cast that one vote. The bill is 16 pages long. It emphasizes the importance of every single vote on every page that we have in this bill. And last year was the first time many Alaskans voted by mail, and we would like to make it more convenient to do so from here on out. Today, we have on available for invited testimony, Amber McReynolds. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the National Vote at Home Institute. Ms. Reynolds is a leading expert on election administration and policy. And then if she's not available, we have Audrey Klein, who is the National Policy Director for the Vote at Home Institute. We also have Patty McGuire. He's an expert on elections with extensive experience with many of the reforms proposed in this bill, House Bill 66. He served as the Oregon Deputy Secretary of State from 2000 to 2007 and is currently the auditor for Mason County, Washington. He's also a graduate here at Juneau Douglas High School. Also, we have Kendra Klosser. She is the Executive Director of the National People's Action and Native People's Action Community Fund. She's a former staffer here in the legislature, and she's been the driving force behind some of the reforms that we see here in House Bill 66. And then also available for questions, I hope she's still available, is Gail Thanumi-Ikes. I know she has a conflict with another elections bill on the other body. And she's the director of Alaska Divisions of Elections. And then Tom Flynn with the Department of Law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, we're going to turn to invited testimony. The first person I have on the list for invited testimony is Patty McGuire, an expert on elections with experience in some of the reforms proposed in House Bill 66. Mr. McGuire is on Teams. And Mr. McGuire, if you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your comments. At this point, I'm not going to put a time limit on it, but if you get going too far, I may ask you to wind up.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Patty McGuire. I'm the county auditor in Mason County, Washington. I very much appreciate the invitation from Representative Tuck to speak today. I'm sorry I can't be with you in Juneau. As Representative Tuck mentioned, I'm a J.D. High graduate, and the first job that I had where I had to learn how to tie a necktie was as a page in the Alaska House of Representatives in 1977. I've devoted the last 20 years of my career to elections as Oregon Deputy Secretary of State, Deputy Director of the Federal Voting Assistance Program, the Pentagon agency that ensures that service members and their families get to vote wherever they are in the world, and now as the elected county auditor in a rural county on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. I've been an expert witness on ballot drop boxes in federal court and co-authored a book about direct democracy, the initiative, referendum, and recall process. I've reviewed House Bill 66 and believe that it is a significant step forward in correcting issues in Alaska law to make voting from home easier and more accessible. One of the important lessons from the 2020 election is that people all over this country want the safety and convenience of voting from home. As states eased outdated restrictions on voting from home, people voted with their feet and picked that option in record numbers. As a longtime election administrator, I'm here to tell you that there is nothing in this bill that has not been done successfully elsewhere. I'll highlight a couple of those things and talk in more detail if there are questions. Allowing voters to choose to get ballots at home permanently is easier for election administrators than having voters make repeated requests. It's also much more convenient for voters. At the point in 1998 when Oregon adopted vote by mail, 70% of Oregonians had chosen to become permanent absentee voters. Washington introduced same-day voter registration amidst everything else happening last year, and while implementation presented some challenges, it was heartening to be able to tell people that they could still get registered and vote on Election Day rather than sending them away mad or sad. Washington implemented prepaid return postage in 2018. It was immediately popular among our voters. Providing a way for voters to cure mistakes, and we try and avoid using the word fix in elections, is an important part of our process here. My staff sends a letter with a postage paid return postcard to every voter that forgets to sign their ballot envelope or if the signatures do not match, and then we follow up with a phone call to every one of those voters. In addition to being a service to our voters, this is an important safety measure. One of the potential fraud cases that I referred to the sheriff from last November was discovered by contacting the voters after the signatures didn't match. Witness requirements are burdensome to voters and provide no security purpose. If a person is going to forge a voter's signature, they will certainly also forge or invent a witness signature. We begin processing ballots the day after we mail them out. We sort, check signatures, open envelopes, scan ballots beginning 17 days before the election. Our ballot tally software does not allow us to get results prior to 8 p.m. on election day, and the staff that handles ballots are sworn election workers. It's also a felony to reveal results early. Finally, on paying election workers in a rural Washington county, I pay my election workers $15 to $18 an hour. I was amazed to learn that the rate of pay in Alaska is lower. I could not keep the great temporary workers that I have for $12 an hour. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and Representative Tuck, for having me here today.
Thank you, Mr. McGuire. Next in invited testimony, we're going to go to Amber McReynolds. Ms. McReynolds, as you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone because that makes it sometimes quite difficult to hear. If you want to proceed, then identify yourself for the record and any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed with your invited testimony. She's not on Teams, she's on the phone. She's not answering. All right, we will give, maybe she'll connect back. We'll next then turn to Kendra.
Oh, I'm on.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee for inviting me to speak today. As mentioned, my name is Amber McReynolds. I'm currently the CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute. We are a national nonpartisan nonprofit that works on expanding access to vote at home and also improving election systems overall. We believe that the values that are important for policymakers to consider in the election process are fairness, accessibility, security, transparency, equity, and also reliability in our election systems. We believe that House Bill 66, and we're grateful to Representative Tuck for putting this forward, we believe that this bill achieves all of those very important values in the election process. As a former elections official myself in Colorado, we greatly expanded the access that voters had to the vote-by-mail process. And over time, voters chose that method of voting in record numbers, similar to what we saw in the 2020 election cycle. We saw more voters engage with the vote-by-mail process across the country. But we've also seen that increase happen over the last three decades, where more and more voters have found this method of voting to be a convenient and secure and accessible option for them. So we applaud the efforts of Representative Tuck and also the independent co-sponsor, Representative Schrag, on this bill. The goal is always, of course, to make it easier to access the ballot box, but also improve security in elections. We believe that this bill expands access and also modernizes Alaska's elections and responds to what Alaskans have chosen to use in the voting method, given the record number of vote-by-mail ballots cast last year. The bill also makes it more convenient to vote before Election Day and also vote on Election Day. So, again, expanding voters' choice in the process is absolutely important. It makes permanent some of the changes implemented last year, which allowed so many Alaskans to vote safely. And it's a critical step in moving toward a more equitable and accessible voting system for all. We applaud the efforts of Alaska over the last few years to further expand access for voters. And I myself also, I think, testified in front of the legislature 2 years ago about some of these issues. So, again, thank you for your consideration of improving the voting process. And I'm available for questions. So I'm grateful for to be here and happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on invited testimony, we have Kendra Kloster, Executive Director of Native Peoples Action and Native Peoples Action Committee Community Fund. And I see Ms. Kloster on Teams, so I know you're here if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your invited testimony.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate being here with the committee today. Again, my name is Kendra Kloster. I'm the Executive Director of Native Peoples Action and Native Peoples Action Community Fund. I am originally from Wrangell and Juneau, though I currently live and work raising my family here on Dena'ina lands in Anchorage. And just for a little bit of background, NPA and NPACF, they're two sibling indigenous nonprofit organizations. We focus on protecting our traditional way of life and providing Alaska Native communities with a voice at all levels of policymaking. Looking at their different reforms that House Bill 66 has done, and this is probably our, third time's a charm, hopefully. As you all know, I've been in front of the committee multiple times in different forms as, of course, working for Representative Tuck before and helping with this legislation. But before that, of being an advocate and working with Get Out the Native Vote even before I came on with NPA and the legislatures, looking at voting reforms there too. And this bill has taken many different forms as we keep learning about more and more things that are coming and are happening in our state. So this year, I just want to talk a little bit about what we did to help inform some of the information that we got back from our communities. This year, Native Peoples Action Community Fund, we actually hired 15 rural voter engagement specialists, and we sent out more than 57,000 absentee ballot applications. We chose to really focus on this because we knew and we heard from our communities the concerns about COVID, the questions around how voting works and how we can make sure to get absentee ballots. So we really put a lot of emphasis behind this. Some of the things that I just want to share, as we had people reaching out in all different regions to talk about the number of just voting issues and voting barriers that came up. For example, we had multiple people tell us they could not cross the river to get to their voting location. Either it was the ice was too thin, and so they were not able to cross. So looking at some of the reforms that 66 does is being able to sign up for permanent absentee voting, I think, and get a ballot sent to you automatically would also be a really big help in some of those circumstances of not knowing what the weather is going to do to get to your polling location. We had a number of people tell us we tried to request a ballot online, and then they have actually never received it, and they tried calling the office and still was never able to get one. That was one of the main things that we heard. Communities that were on lockdown, there was difficulty voting there, and many people had stated that they were not able to vote because they weren't sure how to vote with their community on lockdown. We also heard from people that their post office was closed, so not being able to find a stamp. And so reaching out to community members to say, I saw a post on Facebook, do you have a stamp? I need to be able to mail in my ballot because post offices were closed. So these are just some of the things that we've heard about, and this is not new. These are things that we hear probably every single year. And some other examples we talked about that are in this bill is ballot curing. I talked to individuals that had their ballot rejected and they weren't really sure why. They called the division and we don't have ballot curing or be able to fix that mistake if your signatures don't match or find out what that is. Many states have this option to cure your ballot and highly believe that this is something that Alaska also needs to be doing. We need to be doing everything we possibly can to decrease the barriers. And this is one step in order to be doing that. I'm not saying that House Bill 66 is going to be the only thing that's going to fix it. I think that there's a number of different things that we need to be doing. We heard from a number of individuals that just needed more information and education about how to vote, how to just get their ballot. And so I really would also like to encourage our division and our state to be doing that outreach all year round, telling people how to vote. Language access is also a big issue. We have many people that are, you know, Yupik speakers first. We need more emphasis around language. We have 20 Alaska Native languages that are recognized in the state. And here where I live in East Anchorage, I think many of us have heard this, we have over 100 languages spoken in our schools out here, and we really need to have focus and make sure it's accessible to people.
Ms. Kloster, you've been going for about 5 minutes with your invited testimony. If you could go ahead and conclude, I know that committee members may have questions that may be appropriate for you to answer, but if you want to wind up your remarks, that would be great.
Yes, no problem. I could probably go on for a long time, and so I will just encourage everyone that if you have any questions, please reach out. I'm happy to talk more, answer any questions on this. I appreciate House Bill 66 coming forward, and I hope that we can continue to look at ways that we can decrease voting barriers. This is a nonpartisan issue. This is something that we need to ensure every single Alaskan, no matter where they live, whether it's rural or urban, have the opportunity to vote and the same opportunities to be able to vote. So, again, I appreciate being here today and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. That brings us now to questions from the committee. For any either the bill sponsor or any of the invited testimony folks that are online, I know that we do have public testimony coming up today and a number of people who would like to testify. So, Representative Kirka, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. probably will have lots of questions and more questions later, but for now, on page 1, line 11, looks like we're opening the door to registering to vote and doing away with a 30-day, I guess, deadline before an election to vote, which I can see the prudence of that. I've certainly had conversation with folks that weren't aware or didn't or failed to register before a deadline when they'd recently moved into an area or had recently come of age, and having unnecessary, I guess, limits can be an issue. But I am concerned about verifying citizenship of individuals and not having enough time to do so. And I was going through and looking for, I guess, that process, and I'm not seeing it quite yet. What is the process that the safeguard we're going to have to verify the citizenship of individuals? Because it just seems like there's not enough time to do that. Of individuals who register in the 30-day period.
You're past your minute mark, and I think there is a question for your Representative Tuck to ask or answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the Chair, Representative Kirka. So currently, we have a 30-day residency requirement in Alaska's Constitution. So this does not circumvent that, so I want to make sure that's very clear. However, somebody that might be registered in a different district or a different precinct that wants to come in and vote, this allows them to change their voter registration right there, or even if someone who is fully qualified to vote and has Alaska residency, they can still register and vote that same day. And those, so they would have to vote either a question ballot, a special needs ballot, or what's the third one? An absentee in-person ballot. Those all get counted the same way, those all get reviewed the same way, and that all gets verified to make sure that people do have their citizenship, make sure people do have their residency, and make sure that they are qualified to vote in that particular area. And if you look at section 10, you'll see that section 12, you'll see that lines 25 through 31 have been eliminated, and then on to page 7. Lines 1 and 2 have been eliminated, but that's because it's added into Section 13. So Section 13 pretty much determines how someone, once they vote a question ballot, a special needs ballot, or an in-person absentee ballot, that ballot will be qualified.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I see here on page 2, I guess this is still, this is now Section 2, related to the first question, I guess. Line 30, 31, and then the next page on 3, the new language there that's being added. I think this is probably a good direction that the voter might know that, hey, you can't vote in two different jurisdictions, you can't be registered in two different jurisdictions. But I guess if they're not informing the director what jurisdiction they moved from and which jurisdiction they need to be removed from the voter rolls, how will the director know how to contact or who to contact and what other state? I don't see a language in that regard in this section.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Kirka, for the question. Yeah, we do. The last state of Alaska has subscribed to the ERIC program, and man, I'm going to mess it up. I think it's Elections Registration Integrity. I can't remember what the C stands for. Commission, I believe it is, or committee. I forgot what it is. It's not neither one of those. But basically, there is a verification just like underneath, similar, if you will, the Real ID Act, where you can verify before someone changes their voter registration, verify they're not registered in any other state. So there's like they send out a ping, you know, is a Representative Kirka registered anywhere else? And then the other states will respond back and say, well, we have a Representative Kirka over here. So then they go to the next identification to see if it's the same same Christopher Kirka or a different Christopher Kirka. So that's pretty much the, I forgot what we pay annually for that, but the state of Alaska does subscribe to that system for verification, voter verification.
And Representative Kirka, I'm going to give you one more follow-up now, then we're going to open public testimony because I don't want to, with our 3 o'clock time, I don't want to not let everybody that's here have the opportunity to get their public testimony on the record.
Then I'll, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I'll confine my question to that specific point. So with that system we have for verifying the identity of voters and making sure they're not registered in other states, that process will take place within that 30-day time period before an election?
It would be, through the chair, Representative Kirkett, it would be during the time period all the way up to certifying the election and counting that ballot. And I have to ask the Director of Elections, Gail Fanumiai, to better clarify, but a question ballot can go all the way up to just before the ballots will be counted. And a lot of times your question ballots are set aside, and if they determine the outcome of an election, then they further investigate that question ballot. So yes, they would verify that first that the person's American citizen, second that they're registered in the state of Alaska and indeed have residency in the state of Alaska, and third that they're not qualified to vote in a different precinct, district, or state.
Okay, what we're going to do now, we're going to open public testimony in this matter. We will, as a committee, be able to return to questions, but since we have a number of people online that want to provide public testimony, we're going to turn to that. I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 66. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it's often difficult to hear what you're saying. I'll look around the room. I don't see anyone here who is here to provide public testimony. I note the only folks are Representative Tuck staff and Mr. Kitchenman, who's a news reporter, and I'm confident he's not here to provide public testimony. So the first in the queue is Joel Hansen, calling from Sitka. Mr. Hansen, I'd note we limit public testimony to 2 minutes per speaker. You can proceed. Please identify yourself, any affiliation you may have, and then you can tell us your thoughts on House Bill 66.
Good afternoon, Chairman Klayman, committee members. My name is Joel Hansen. I'm from Sitka, and I'm testifying on my own behalf. I support HB 66. I'm retired now, but most of my working life over the last 40 years here in Alaska has been spent on the water, early on as a commercial fisherman and since 1996 as a small cruise ship fleet operations manager and captain. I haven't even tried to make it to the polling place on voting day more than just a few times since I first voted in Alaska in 1980. But I've never missed a chance to vote, and that's thanks to either mail-in or absentee voting provisions. Like the majority of Alaskans, I enthusiastically voted in favor of the Permanent Fund-linked Automatic Voter Registration Program with its opt-out provision. HB 66 leaves this AVR system intact, while SB 39, on the other hand, proposes to change it to an opt-in provision. I've only heard one rationale for making this change, and it seems a very weak one to me. But no matter the reason for it, I believe the result would be a substantial reduction in voter participation unless same-day registration at a polling station were to be provided. SB 39 fails to make such a provision, but HB 66, just to make voting as inclusive as possible, provides for same-day registration. I listened to all the stories of 2020 voting irregularities offered by members of the public who testified in favor of SB 36 in recent hearings, and I have no doubt about the sincerity of their concerns or the fact that some suspicious things did appear to occur. And I have no doubt that some bad actors might have been up to some mischief in the weeks leading up to the election. But despite all this, none of the testimony I heard convinced me that any significant number of fraudulent votes were ever actually cast. In fact, when most of the testifiers were asked what they did with the unrequested ballots they received in the mail or the ballots that got handed them by a stranger on a college campus or a street corner, without a pause, they all admitted to doing exactly what most people would do under those circumstances.
Mr. Hansen, you're at about the two-minute mark. If you want to conclude your remarks, that would be great.
In summary, we need a good, clear voting rule, good safeguards, and as many opportunities for all Alaskans to participate as possible. This bill achieves that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we have Terry Lyons. Ms. Lyons, if you want to identify yourself and anyone you're affiliated with, you can proceed with your testimony.
My name is Terry Lyons, and I'm speaking for myself. I oppose HB 66, in particular the electronic signatures and early voting. Witness signatures must be enforced. The court unlawfully ruled on signatures not being needed. I oppose pay raises. The state is broke, according to the legislature. No one should be getting pay raises. The bullet points and goals on this bill will leave us open to extreme voter fraud. Additionally, my husband and I both receive absentee ballots, and I know the difference between an absentee ballot and a request for one. My husband's been gone now, passed away 2.5 years ago, and the state has been notified that he passed away just within days of when that happened. Our border rules need to be cleaned up. I know this is not a priority for a lot of legislatures. You are undermining fair and just elections, and I consider this bill to be un-American, and I wholeheartedly consider it unconstitutional. I disagree with what Chris Tuck has said, and I feel this bill has been introduced despite the bill the Senate is working on. And that is all I have to say on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we have Doug Woodby. Mr. Woodby, if you want to identify yourself for the record, you can proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Klayman and committee members. My name is Doug Woodby, and I live in Juneau, and I'm representing myself. And thanks for this opportunity to comment. I'm calling to support HB 66 for five reasons. Number one, it expands voting access. Number two, it modernizes Alaska's elections. Number three, it makes it more convenient to vote before Election Day. Four, it makes it easier to vote on Election Day. And five, it requires the Division of Elections to let a voter know if there was something wrong with their absentee ballot and it was rejected. And it allows them to fix it if there are errors. And no one should be punished for making a simple mistake on their ballot and by having their whole vote thrown away. So it gives people the chance to fix their mistakes and to make sure they're counted. And that's all I have. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woodby. Next in the queue, Lauren Peterson, calling from Anchorage. Mr. Peterson, or Ms. Peterson, please identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Klayman. Yes, this is Lauren Peterson. I am the president and chairman of Satrac Incorporated, which is a village corporation with headquarters in Anchorage that serves the bulk of shareholders in western Alaska in Mountain Village on the lower Yukon. Which is an area that has been disenfranchised in a lot of different political areas, including in elections as well. And so we found that our board unanimously passed this resolution to start supporting the idea of ballot carrying in our state. It is a very American issue. It touches on the true fundamentals of our democracy, that all votes should be counted. I myself have been an active voter when it comes to elections. I watched my dad and my parents vote, and I've also seen their signatures change over time. So I know that signatures do change over time. My signature has also changed over time, and I understand that sometimes ballots are rejected based on signatures that might be different than what's on file. And we wholeheartedly support the idea of ballot curing. It's overdue. It needs to be modernized. So many states are moving towards this. It's the fair way to treat voters in each election, to allow them to be notified of a rejected ballot and the opportunity to correct that ballot. We all have the right to vote, and Alaska Natives embrace voting. We've been voting for about 50 years now, and the state is a very beautiful and rich state with a diverse citizenship. And I think really this idea of correcting ballots and ballot carrying and a lot of these other provisions in this bill that Representative Tuck has introduced, we support it. It makes sense. It's a fair way of really engaging with citizens and their right to vote.
Mr. Peterson, you're at about the two-minute mark. If you want to conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Okay, thank you. Also want to also get the committee to please consider, if not already, that mail-in ballots be allowed for curing, because in the bill it does look like this applies to absentee ballots, but it doesn't say anything about mail-in ballots. So mail-in ballots should also be included. And, you know, with our historically, every year it does seem like we get kind of a low voter turnout, 50% or less, and allowing voters to have their vote be counted hones in on that democratic approach to, like, allowing a true representation of a voter. So
thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time, Mr. Peterson. Next in the queue, we have Celeste Hodge-Graben. If you want to identify yourself for the record and any affiliation you may have.
Through the chair, members of the House Judiciary Committee, good afternoon. My name is Celeste Hodge-Groudon. I am the president and CEO of the Alaska Black Caucus, a nonpartisan organization that advocates for the lives of Black and BIPOC communities in the areas of health, education, economics, and justice. For nearly a decade, I served as the president of the local NAACP, the largest and oldest civil rights organization in the world. Currently, I serve as the second vice president. Across the country, and even here in the great state of Alaska, we've seen voter suppression bills crop up that use fear-based and unsubstantiated rhetoric to try to erode our hard-won voting rights. House Bill 66 is a brave and much-needed piece of legislation that not only stands up to that attempt to disenfranchise America's voters, but ensures that every Alaskan has the right to safely and legally make their vote heard at the ballot box. As the president, I would like to testify in support of House Bill 66. As shared, the Alaska Black Caucus is a nonpartisan organization with the goal of ensuring that minorities, people of color, voices that have a seat at the table when decisions are being made, and one of the most important tables there are is the ballot box. House Bill 66 continues the Alaska legacy of ensuring that every legal vote in Alaska will be counted. And one of the most important ways it does that is ensuring that Alaskans across have access to vote by mail. Vote by mail simply allows more Alaskans to participate. And those that say that we don't need vote by mail and every Alaskan should be able to line up and vote during the week probably aren't among the 40,000 single parent households juggling work and children, or the Alaskans who don't have reliable transportation to get them to the polls. They probably don't suffer from a disability and rely on a family or community members to transport them. They probably aren't working multiple jobs to feed their families and make ends meet. When you say it isn't easy to make the time to show up in person on voting day, let's be clear in saying that you are showing your privilege. Having the time and the transportation to get to a polling place is a privilege that not everyone has.
Ms. Hodge-Groudon, you're at about the two-minute mark. If you want to conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Well, let me just say, House Bill 66 makes voting more secure and more accessible at the same time. And we are done sitting idly by while continuing to watch the parade of all these injustices unfold before us. We are not going back to the days of having to correct or count the number of jelly beans in a jar in order for some to vote. I encourage the members of this committee and all members of the Alaska legislature to support House Bill 66.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hodge-Groudon. Next in the queue, Jessica Lindman, calling in. If you want to identify yourself for the record, you can proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Jessica Lindman, and I'm in Palmer. I am in favor of HB 66. My first 12 years after 18, I lived in Oregon, where it is all mail-in voting, automatic. There are no in-person polling places, and it was amazing. It was secure. There's never been reports of large amount of fraud in Oregon, and it made it easy to, at your own schedule, if you worked long hours. I have small children now that are very hard to get to a polling place. Years like COVID, flu season is always in November. I am a very big fan of choosing the absentee permanently and the being able to cure a ballot. That was also allowed in Oregon, and I was very surprised when moving here that that is not an option. So to summarize, I am happy with all parts of HB 66, and I am in support of it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lindman. Next in the queue, Rick Phillips, calling from Anchorage. If you want to identify yourself for the record and any affiliation you may have, please proceed.
Okay. All right, thanks. To the chair and the committee, my name is Rick Phillips. I'm representing myself. I'm calling in support of House Bill 66, and I support any bill that makes it easier to register to vote and to vote. And with your permission, if I could read a short paragraph in the Alaska Constitution, Amendment 15, voting rights says, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. I don't know why we have bills that are trying to oppress voting rights. And I think it says in the Constitution we have the right to vote. Maybe we should be registered to vote when we're born, and you just change that state to state as you get older. But I support a lot of the things people were saying in the past that are supporting this. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Next in the queue is Alex Copland calling from Homer. Mr. Copland, if you want to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. To Mr. Clayman, my name is Alex Copland. I live in Homer, Alaska. I'm a member of Kenai Peninsula Votes. We are a nonpartisan group of citizens that promote voting. We don't care who you vote for, but we want you to vote. With that said, we are much in favor of House Bill 66. Director Fununiai and her staff and Lieutenant Governor did a great job last November in our election. My sincerest thanks for their efforts. House Bill 66 carries much of those changes that we made, but also adds, the curing of the balance is a wonderful idea. Payment for envelopes, yes. Not having to worry about a witness signature is fantastic. We've never in the state's history had a witness signature situation crop up where we found any voter fraud. It's a placeholder, it seems. Permanent absentee balloting really supports people that are outside, people that are already in villages, harder to get to places. It's a wonderful thing. By the way, I was a poll worker, and pay raises would be much appreciated. It sounds like the director has been informed that Senate Bill 39 has already gone through testimony. There has been no public testimony for that bill as of date, and it's had plenty of hearings, so I'm just impressed that we had this hearing today. The only concern I have about this bill is we had 98,000 absentee ballots this last election, and I want to make sure we have some sort of signature verification software or whatever it is, and those people in Washington and Oregon are more familiar with that. And I don't know how exactly we do verify those signatures, except that if they're mailed and they go back to the House, and so there is that trail. And I know that voting absentee is very safe and secure because there is the paper trail. This is a wonderful bill. I would love to see co-sponsors from the other side of the aisle so that when we make voting bills, we have a more general agreement instead of these one-sided arguments that we need to move away from. I want to thank you guys for having this public testimony today. Voting should be easy. It should be accessible. And people need to feel that it's secure and safe. And we have a group that needs to understand that. And I think we just need to bridge that divide. But I appreciate Representative Tuck again because
Mr. Copland, you're a little past the two-minute mark. If you want to wind up your remarks, that'd be great.
No, I'm good, and thank you very much, and good luck, and I appreciate all the work everybody does.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue is Charles McKee calling from Anchorage. Mr. McKee, identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm a beneficiary of the McKee Trust. I am the holder in due course to the straw man name that was in possession by the state of Alaska. I lease it back, the all-cap name, Charles Edis McKee. I have a business license and a corporate license registered in all-cap, Charles Edis McKee. And therefore, to explain to you my position, I highly reject, the liability position you're trying to place on these unsuspecting people that are subjugated by your corporate process. RICO charges should be applied to your action. RICO violation, because you're ignoring corporate opposed to the private civilian. You're trying to extenuate the private civilian from existence. And I'm appalled at the fact that that's why I've made testimony previously against the SB 39 voting application filing. And that was done January 28th, 2021. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Mr. McKee. Next in the queue is Cassie Laver, calling from Homer. Ms. Laver, if you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you might have, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Cassie Laver. I'm a resident of Homer, and I'm just calling to oppose HB 66. Just everything about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Laver. You get the award for the shortest testimony so far today. Next in the queue, John Sonnen, calling from Douglas, Alaska. Mr. Sonnen, if you want to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Clayman. John Sonnen, S-O-N-I-N, representing Civilized Humanity from over here on Douglas, across the pond there from you guys. And I was trying to hang on to what the first naysayer, Shower Acolyte, I think, with his take out the automatic registration from the PFD bill. When I did, it looks like it, you know, like I just ran up behind another one. Everybody else on this testimony have been in support of Reptuck's bill, which is beyond needed. It's essential because so many of these shower alkalites are running around living a lie, and we cannot continue to let this dementia persist. The only way we can avoid it is with free and fair elections like we've had, making it easier for people to vote, which is an absolute necessity when we have so many rural electorate that cannot have time to go the 300-mile trip to voting location. And even for the bigger cities, the expansion of voting early and the absentee in person from being able to vote out of district is it's probably less than what I'm sorry, probably less than what could be done with. It's more than anybody can really ask for in this time of post national bifurcation.
Mr. Sonnen, you're at about the 2-minute mark. If you want to conclude your remarks, that would be great.
I'm sorry. I can go on forever. Basic bottom line, Reptuck's bill is perfect and must be passed by you guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think you've summarized it very effectively in your perspective on it. Next in the queue is Mr. Mike Coons, calling on behalf of himself, Mr. Coons, if you want to identify yourself for the record and state any affiliation you may have, you can proceed with your testimony.
Yes, this is Mike Coons. I'm speaking for myself, and I am privileged. I have scanned through HB 66. This has zero to do with effective election reform. The only bill progressing is SB 39 with a new CS coming this week with even better improvements that does real election reform for all voters equally. Yet, sadly, I'm sure this committee chair will not bring forth SB 39 when it comes forward. I fully expect the speaker will put multiple committees onto SB 39, which we all know is the means of killing a bill. HB 66 allows same-day registration and voting, curing, and no witness signature. All of these put a big hole wide open for fraud. What do we need to cure? Why do we need to cure ballots like Pennsylvania did, only for Democrats, not for Republicans? The Senate voted down taking off the witness signature last session, even though a liberal judge made sure that the legislature's intent didn't matter. I'm so tired of the socialist left pushing for weakening our elections so that more and more votes can come in to support socialism and those reps and senators that support socialism. I am so tired that when an outstanding senator like Mike Shower, who has served our nation in battle, unlike most in this House have done, supports real solid election reforms, his attack wrongfully is racist. By the way, I am privileged to being an American and an Alaskan, unlike the NAACP and the Black Caucus testifier that pulled the race card. Notice I didn't say my race. I am sure that this committee will disregard my and other testimonies and will pass out, and that the socialist majority in the House will vote for HB 66. I can bet this is dead on arrival in the Senate. Sadly, this House will block SB 39 as well. By the way, as being from the former great state of Oregon, to have the testimony from Oregon in support shows just how bad this bill is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. Representative Eastman, did you have something?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Could we just reiterate to those participating in testimony to share their views, absent criticism of other people testifying?
And Representative Eastman, I think that's a fair request, and I certainly could have interjected. Mr. Coons was saying some things that I think all of us were more than happy not to pay attention to.
Thank you.
And so next we have Ms. Annette Alfonsi calling from Anchorage. Ms. Alfonsi, if you want to identify yourself for the record and any affiliation you may have, you may proceed.
Hello, my name is Annette Alfonsi. I'm calling on behalf of myself, but I'm also the Volunteer Alaska partner for the Unmasking Brain Injury Project, which raises awareness and education specifically around invisible disability and brain injury. Years ago, when I was a passenger in a rollover car accident with a reckless driver, I ended up in a wheelchair for a period of time, and the polling place that I had at that time has a curb around it. And so while there's a curb cutout, the door is very, very heavy, and I was unable to open it. If it weren't for my mom being with me and driving with me to that polling place, even if I made it up to the door, I wouldn't have been able to open the door and vote, and I would have gone home. Frankly, I would have gone home and cried. So I am actually calling in support of this bill and am thrilled with the access and availability for people who need special needs ballots, options, or who have disabilities to be able to access their constitutional right to vote. I just love those expansion of options, and I've spoken with a lot of folks who are disenfranchised voters with various types of invisible or visible disabilities who have tried to vote or otherwise been denied access and who basically don't want to try anymore. They're kind of living in a victim mentality, which makes sense when they are not able to access their right to vote. So I often say that I can live with the results of any election as long as it's a representative election. So if people are not able to access their right to vote, then it's not a representative election. So, and lastly, I'd just like to suggest that from my perspective, a voter signature verification contact to me seems like it's a form of fraud quality control, and I really appreciate the idea of being able to contact someone whose signature doesn't quite match up. So thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Next in the queue, we have Bert Hofteling calling from Big Lake. Mr. Hofteling, and I apologize if I mispronounced your name, please identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Bert Hofteling. I represent myself and about 4,000 other Alaskans who follow what I say. I am 100% against House Bill 66. This is going to do nothing more than weaken our elections and make it easier for potential voter fraud to happen, eliminating witness signatures. This is just one step closer to saying you won't need an ID when you go to vote at the polls. When you guys, I find it disingenuous when you say that this was the most secure election that we have seen in history last year, when 113,000 Alaskans' voters' information was stolen a good month prior to the elections, and we were not notified it until a month after the elections are over. We still don't know how many of those people that voted through that process of absentee ballots that could have come from that stolen information that potentially never did cast a vote, because nobody has done any further investigations upon this. This bill here is nothing more than what the Democrats and the, as we like to say, the far left judicial branch put into place
Mr. Hoftelling, as the representative of Eastman reminded us, your purpose is to provide your opinion and not to suggest the motives of others that may have different interests in this particular legislation. Please limit yourself to your perspective.
This is my perspective. The judicial branch subverted the system out there by unilaterally changing the way our voting system is to be held here in Alaska. They subverted both the executive and the judicial branch, by the executive and the legislative branch, for what is authoritatively in their control, not theirs. Now you want to make this subversion that had happened prior in the November election as an addition to the laws, and you want to make them permanent so that it makes it that much easier to subvert our elections. I am 100% against this bill. If you truly want to have reforms done, you need to take what is the best within the bill that you have here right now and get in line and step with SB 39 and see what you can incorporate.
Mr. Hoftelling, you're about the two-minute mark. If you want to conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time listening today.
Thank you very much. Next in queue, we have Nick Moe calling from Anchorage. Mr. Moe, please identify yourself for the record and state any affiliation you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Nick Moe. I'm calling from Anchorage. I'm calling in representing myself, and I'm calling to support HB 66 and specifically two of the elements in it. The first is ballot curing. It's long overdue that Alaska has had a process for curing a ballot. I just looked it up before this hearing, and there was more than 1,100 ballots that were rejected in Alaska this last November without any way for those voters to correct a signature or other clerical error. And I think it should, Alaska voters have the right to have that opportunity. So I appreciate that being included in this bill. And I also would like to support the same-day registration. Previously, I worked at University of Alaska Anchorage as a government relations director as a student in student government. And I can't tell you how many conversations I had with students who wanted to participate in the process but couldn't because they were within the 30-day deadline to register. And especially with local and state races, by the time you hear that there is a race or candidates can afford TV and radio, it's too late to register. And so especially for younger and new voters, I think that's especially important for them to be involved in the process. So I appreciate this committee hearing this bill, and I encourage support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moe. Next in the queue, we have Evan Anderson calling from Anchorage. Mr. Anderson, if you want to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Clayman, and thanks to the committee for hearing this bill. My name is Evan Anderson. I'm calling on behalf of myself, and I'm also Director of Civic Engagement with the Alaska Center Education Fund. I'm calling in support of House Bill 66. Others have mentioned the 2020 election, and I think that it's really important to focus in on some of the successes and the ways that the state was able to adapt and ensure that everyone's voice could be heard in the midst of a global pandemic. Through the Alaska Center Education Fund, we've engaged tens of thousands of Alaskans in the electoral process, many for the first time since 2016 in the passage of automatic voter registration. With those 70,000 new voters on the rolls since 2016, there's more work to do to ensure that all those voters know their rights and know that they have the opportunity to vote every August, every November, and in every local election that comes around as well. Together with the Alaska Civic Engagement State Table, we carried out an election protection program that had 165 shifts completed in 12 communities around the state. We ran an 866-R-Vote statewide hotline that garnered hundreds of calls from voters looking for support all around the state. In the effort to get out the word about the election, we think that same-day voter registration and permanent absentee voter could be some of the most effective reforms to help cut down on that election day confusion or that 7 p.m. scramble to get to the polls and really ensure that everyone's voice can be heard and that elections are accessible to all. The last thing I'll say is that my belief is that the rising Alaskan electorate, which I consider to be young people, women, Black, Indigenous, and people of color voters, naturalized immigrants, people with disabilities, queer and trans Alaskans, and rural Alaskans, are by every measure the future of the electorate. And so at any time that we are excluding those populations of voters with our policies that might currently be on the books, we've got to look to expand the electorate. And
Mr. Anderson, you're at about the 2-minute mark. If you want to conclude your remarks, that would be great.
That's it. Just in great support of HB 66, and thanks to Representative Tuck as the sponsor and Representative.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next in the queue is Rebecca Moore calling from Homer. Ms. Moore, if you want to identify yourself for the record, state any affiliation, you can proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Moore. I live in Homer, Alaska, and I represent myself. I strongly, strongly oppose HB 66. This is about election integrity. We need elections that have integrity. It is vital to our process. And this bill has many facets that highly concern me and should concern every Alaska citizen. We are ignoring election integrity, and this bill does not provide reform for integrity. It does nothing for our election integrity. And I don't understand why we are suddenly needing election overalls of our elections. Why are we weakening versus strengthening our election integrity? So just having votes pouring in, it doesn't mean anything if there's a weakening in the integrity of the voting system. So I strongly, strongly oppose HB 66 for these reasons, and I thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Moore. I see no one else in the room that wants to testify, and Ms. Moore was the last person that showed up on the queue for calling in from on the phone and from the various other locations. So I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 66. Right on schedule. So this is what my plan. When we come back on Wednesday, we'll be able to take up questions on House Bill 66, and I'd ask Representative Tuck to have some of the same folks available on Wednesday to answer questions that may come up. We'll also do our best to get the Ms. Funumiai, the Director of the Division of Elections, as well as Tom Flynn, Assistant Attorney General, connected with some of these elections issues available for questions. So we'll take up questions on House Bill 66 on Wednesday. We will also, I think, hear the comparison on House Bill 116 between House Bill 105 and House Bill 116. I would encourage members of the committee to also do their own independent review of the two bills and not just rely on what the department comes up. And in terms of amendments, my goal would be to have a deadline for amendments on House Bill 116, which is the juvenile bill, 5 p.m. on Thursday, April 15, and at least my tentative thought on an amendment deadline for House Bill 66 would be 5 p.m. on Friday. That would be the goal at this point. That might change depending on how the hearing goes on Wednesday. Representative Eastman, you had a question.
Just a suggestion, Mr. Chairman. I know it's a highly technical bill with 38 separate sections, and at 2 minutes, that's only about 3 seconds per section. If it's other technical bills like this in the future for public testimony, I think, could we consider maybe up to 3 minutes? Because I know there were a lot of potentially good comments the committee didn't have because of the deadline.
Well, I'll think about it, but as you know, Representative Eastman, it's been a long tradition in this committee the entire time you've been on it that we've kept public testimony to 2 minutes per person, and the public certainly has the opportunity to provide written testimony, and with a bill of this detail, oftentimes the written testimony is sometimes more helpful than the oral testimony, but I'll certainly keep that in mind as we move forward. And with that, I don't think there's anything else we have on the agenda today. Our next meeting is Wednesday, April 14th at 1 p.m., and I think I already mentioned at least two of the topics we'll have on that meeting. And so we'll stand adjourned. The time is 3:02 p.m.